Everyone, welcome to Innovent Korea. Today, our guest, I'm so happy that he's with us, Dr. Mark DeGarmo. Hi, Mark.
Hi, AJ. How are you today?
Oh, great. You are founder, executive, and artistic director at Mark DeGarmo Dance in New York City.
Yes, that's right.
So it's a not-for-profit organization you founded in 87. And so this year, 2022, marks its 35th anniversary. So there will be upcoming celebration in early May.
Yes, we're doing it on Cinco de Mayo on May 5th via Zoom, starting at 6:30 Eastern time till 8 o'clock. And over the last couple of years of the pandemic, one of the things that we discovered that we were able to reach more people internationally than we had even ever hoped to or dreamed that we might be able to. And so this third year of having our virtual Dance for Social Change on the internet rather than in person is another opportunity to be able to invite more people from various parts of the world to join us.
And I will be putting the links to the events in the show notes. So if people want to just join in and discover your work, that'll be possible. So before we dive into today's subject, which is using dance as a social innovation, I'm going to ask you my root question, which is, what as a 10-year-old, what were you fascinated at?
Oh, that's a great question, AJ. I really loved physicality. I loved being outdoors. We were in a time and a place in a very small town where we were able to just be set free to go explore the neighborhood and, you know, the natural environment down to a pond, you know, down a bank, a sandbank. I mean, there were obviously safety precautions, but nonetheless, we were able to really just go out and play. It seemed like 8 hours a day. We could play in the snow. So we had a beautiful glacial lake within walking distance to my home. And the natural environment was just such a mystery. Seeing the stars at night, seeing the moon, the planets. I had a telescope as a 10-year-old, you know, fascinated. And I think that's the main thing. I think that, and also being able to navigate that physically, bike riding, swimming, walking, running. You know, I created a little running team at a certain point when I started running in school. You know, I loved calculations and, you know, tracking, you know, the growth of each of the runners on the team from the neighborhood who were a little younger than me that I could, you know, recruit for convince.
So I hear there was a lot of freedom.
Yes, a tremendous amount of freedom. When I think of today's upbringing for most people I know at their children, we really were set free and almost as though, like, just go and, you know, hope to see you. But there was never any worry, you know. That was the magical thing about it, or the marvelous thing. We had such an opportunity for our individual growth.
And so how did you become a dancer? How did you end up discovering dance as a medium for you to express yourself?
Well, you know, at age 13, I went to boarding school in Massachusetts for 4 years, but when I started, by going to that school and having that curriculum, a couple of years later, I was taking courses in contemporary theater, theater of the absurd, theater of the ridiculous, you know, theater with social action components like the Living Theater. You know, when I later met Judith Malina, the founder, a director, actress of the Living Theater in New York, and we honored her at a Dance for Dance event. You know, I was exposed to happenings. So I started in summers, 2 summers when I came home from school, being in a really small town with nothing to do, no place to be able to access. There was no public transportation anywhere. I created a theater group, and we did happenings and original plays and choreography. When I was 15, I went to the Jacob's Pillow Dance Festival, just over the border from where I live in New York State to Massachusetts, and saw the Laura Lubavitch Dance Company. And absolutely, it was as though a thunderbolt struck me. Mm. I felt like I had an illumination or an epiphany experience, and knew the course of my life somehow. So the next morning, I announced to my family, hey, I'm going to become a dancer and a choreographer.
Wow.
And, you know, none of us knew what that really meant. Later, I realized, like, Laura had gone to Juilliard. A lot of the people in his company were Juilliard people. Mm-hmm. And I later, when I had the opportunity to study at Juilliard, you know, it's been an interesting thing to think about the imprint of those individuals at that time, at that performance.
Yes.
It was even, that night was even, I later realized many years later, I think when I was doing my doctoral study, it dawned on me that the white-haired man that introduced the concert in front of the curtain was the very famous Ted Shawn, who was considered a great grandfather of modern dance in America. He and his wife, Ruth St. Denis. Ruth had gone to the girls' school component of the school I went to. Northfield Mount Hermon. And she was, apparently there's a film of her in her 80s, saying something about, well, every age has its dance, and then demonstrating with her arms one of her famous, beautiful solos. So
a lot of synchronicities that night when you're a young teenager, and then you get this revelation, oh my gosh, that's what I want to do.
Yeah, so I was very lucky. I don't know that I would have had that experience had I stayed and gone to my public high school, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. It was such a different milieu, whereas Northfield Mount Hermon was clearly a national, international program. They had a very advanced language study department. People had the opportunity to study and become exchange students in Russia, Germany. I'd gone to France, to Arcachon, the Lycée de Plein Air, near Bordeaux, and obviously Spanish, but it was really quite a
open
wonderful
up the world, which is what you still profess and do at MDD, at Marc de Garmo Dance, which is still this international a view and influences. When you get out of Juilliard, how did you go from graduating from Juilliard to eventually creating Marc de Garmo Dance?
I had been a little older than my cohort because I'd left Oberlin College, where I was for a semester when I moved to New York when I was 18 to study dance on an independent study project from Oberlin, and then ended up staying. Mm. So I went to Juilliard, auditioned and got into Juilliard about 5 years after the typical cohort.
Oh, wow.
But I had studied, a lot of dance composition. I'd studied in New York for those years and danced with companies and done touring and was starting to do some of my own work. I went into Juilliard knowing I wanted to have a dance company. I knew that I wanted to be a choreographer. I was learning what it meant to be a Western trained concert dancer, and what the physical training would be. And that's why I wanted to go to Juilliard, because it was so intensive. And I was working five nights a week in a restaurant at that point. And I continued that 2 years into the 3 years I was at Juilliard. But, to do that really intensive training. And then after that, it still took me a few years of really intensive ballet training in New York, with my peers, to get that part of my technical work at the level that I'd always dreamed and went to Juilliard to achieve. So that was gratifying, but it still took a number of years to kind of work in different methodologies and different approaches and different speeds and different demands to be able to really consolidate what I did learn at Juilliard. That took a few years to really integrate physically and psychologically. Sure. But I always knew, and so in some ways, the company is 40 years old, because the first, concert I did was in a mall in Paramus, New Jersey, a duet concert with a colleague from Juilliard, and it was a mall. I didn't quite understand what that meant, because I had been in New York during the time a lot of malls were being built in America. And so, you know, there are people on the upper balcony throwing cigarette butts down at us as we
Oh
during
my
the
gosh.
show. But it was like, but we did that like that next June, July when I got out. So I can sort of say that was the beginning of Marc de Garmo dance.
All right. Okay. The first instances were then. But then in 87, that's when you create the organization as we know it today.
Yes, that was when we incorporated as a nonprofit, as Dynamic Forms Inc. You know, the best structure was the nonprofit structure for me. I liked fundraising. I liked
Okay.
community outreach. You know, I liked bringing dance to people who had no idea what you were doing or why, but you know, but they were open to it. And so all of that sort of played into wanting to create a nonprofit, a charity to help the public good.
And so over time, you created Partnership, it's a program, Partnership in Literacy through Dance and Creativity. And it's aimed specifically to disenfranchise and marginalize Title I primary public schools. Can you tell us more specifically what it is and how it came about to be created? Because I believe it was part of an investigation through your PhD.
Yes. after I got out of Juilliard, I realized, you know, I didn't want to work in a restaurant, but I knew how do you make a living in New York? You know, what do you do? How do you do this? So you're not physically exhausted, you know, as a dance person, you want to, you know, put all your energy as much as possible into your physical exploration and growth. But I knew that I had an interest in teaching and in education, and the director of Juilliard suggested I go to the Lincoln Center Institute across the way at Lincoln Center and talk with the head of the education program and try to get my foot in the door, which took a few years. It was so popular with artists who were already established in New York. I did get my foot in the door and worked there about 14 years. I worked with Maxine Green, a philosopher in aesthetic education, often called the John Dewey of our times, was a mentor and was the philosopher in residence that created that program. So I worked with about seven other education programs in New York, including the Joyce Theaters and others. And, you know, basically when I just really wanted to create something that was going to impact students in a very much in-depth way. The programs I had worked with were more what I would call exposure programs. Philosophically, they were really fascinating, research-based, very in-depth. I mean, very almost revolutionary, working with the ideas of people like Paulo Freire and you know, others that were doing, you know, literacy work with people without means in Brazil, which got them thrown in jail and things like that. So really, when you're working with education as community development and as you know,
Can be very revolutionary.
you're rocking the boat if people don't want people to be educated or to be able to read the world, as Freire put it. And so I really very much connected with, as I'm learning through the Institute and Maxine and her lectures and her writings and her thinking about democracy and education. Her book about democracy and education is so pertinent today. It was done about in 86, I think. you know, that's what got me so excited because I kept reflecting on what's my own reason for being in dance and why do I have this passion? What does it matter? I had family members eventually say, like, could you just stop? All you talk about is dance, you know? So it can become all consuming. But when I started seeing the effects on other people of the work, the teaching work that I was doing in the US, in New York, internationally, in Latin America in particular, it just made me realize that there was a through line of kinesthetic thinking, of embodied knowledge, learning, what I theorized as the embodied imagination.
Why this specific area of New York?
Well, we're based in the Lower Manhattan in the Lower East Side, a traditional immigrant neighborhood, and we are this year working in 12 schools with 13 programs in four of the five boroughs, all but Staten Island. And so we started specializing about 20 years ago on working with what are called Title I schools, which is reference to a federal legislation designating a certain amount of resource for schools basically under the federal poverty rate, where 75% or more of the children, sometimes it's up to 100% in our schools, live under the what's called the federal poverty rate,
which
is pretty hard to live on in New York in any case. We had, in the late 90s, had a grant for 2 years in a middle school in the Northern Bronx. And I realized we did not have the resources, the educational understanding and teaching methodological understanding of how to truly reach every middle school student we were working with.
Okay.
You know? And I realized, let's try working younger, because the middle schools, especially in New York, are traditionally very challenged. And the Department of Ed itself is having a heck of a time figuring out how to really deliver the appropriate education to this level of child. And so so that was the idea, that we'd go with pre-K to grade 5, a 7-year cycle. We made an iterative cycle of learning that, as the title suggests, we are working with students learning dance and then writing about it in dance journals. And that's part of the literacy component that we're thinking about. It's a reflective component where the kids are talking with descriptive language about what occurred sequentially in the class and remembering and pulling back up what happened. And then they're talking about their emotional landscape, the mapping of their emotions that might have emerge during this experiential exploration, this live workshop style inquiry. We typically don't, we do not teach a style or a genre. So we don't teach hip hop, or we don't teach bachata, or, you know, ballet. We do pull on principles from modern dance and principles of creative movement, which are typically also grounded in movement improvisation and movement composition or choreography.
Okay.
So it's all about generating movement ourselves, learning how to how movement is generated, how an individual who doesn't even think of herself or themselves or himself as a choreographer, how do we just generate movement, or, and what could be thought of as perhaps original movement for the learner, or innovative, you know, original or innovative learning for the learner.
It gives them a power also, because I've seen the videos, the testimonial videos from a bunch of kids, you know, who participated in the program. And it's so endearing, but it's very moving, because you have kids in there that wouldn't want to participate and eventually came out of their shell and just started to participate. And the effect on them is huge, but it also has an effect for the teachers. That's what some of the testimonials were, right?
Yeah, the teachers as well, clearly, because they're in many cases learning a new approach to teaching. And the theory that I developed is basically reversing the typical Western approach to teaching, which is think.
And you reversed it, and you do first, then you think about it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, it's very simple in a sense, but when you're coming up against a lifetime and maybe lots of institutions that have credentialed you into a certain methodological approach, it's hard to break habits. It's hard to imagine other learners learn in different ways. And for, you know, people like me who are kinesthetic learners, I didn't know that till I worked on my PhD in my late 40s starting, you know. So there's a kind of information, again, that has to come forward in the reflective process, in the writing or the thinking or the creating out of what the experience is. There's
this program in 2011, President Obama commended you and MDD for your commitment to your community and the nation, which is, I mean, something that needs to be highlighted, because the work that you do is profound and affects those kids for the better, time and time again being proven. And the U.S. National Endowment for the Arts called called your organization, the program, a national model. How do you project MDD to be in the future, in 10 years from now, let's say?
I would really like to find, we're working on this through strategic planning processes, as you well know, having been part of the most recent one and continuing into this. So we'll be doing, more to come. But I think the first step is really seeing if it's possible to find a way to, ultimately start building towards transition, that I won't be in my position the rest of my life or, whatever. So trying to figure out some of the transitional pieces of leadership transition. And that means promoting, young people coming up, young professionals, emerging mm-hmm. professionals. And I'm very committed to working with serious emerging professionals with the capacity for rigorous delivery of high quality programming, which is what we're known for and why we've received the kudos and the support yes. that we have. So I'd like to be, AJ, I really want to keep on what we're doing continuing, but potentially expanding in a very thoughtful way. And I can...
If only to get people inspired by the program and perhaps
yes.
implemented elsewhere in a different way or...
Yeah, I'd love... we have invitations to do so in Michoacán, Mexico, where we have many contacts with colleagues since the mid-80s and earlier. And so that's an area I would love to be able to work with because the focus on education in Mexico can be so very inspiring. I have so many colleagues working at every level of from primary all the way through graduate study work and professional work. They're just so inspiring. So I'd like to get a dose of being in Mexico again for a bit and working with the communities and our indigenous community colleagues in the Purépecha community in Michoacán. But, I'd also like to be doing more writing and continuing the publishing. I've been able to do this, especially through the pandemic, with colleagues from Australia to New Zealand and Canada and Denmark and whatnot. And then
pushing the reflections around mm-hmm. how to use dance in new capacities, really.
Absolutely.
And literally change the world, because I think that's what I've seen through the videos. It's changed a lot of kids' life through a new perspective and through learning how to own themselves and their body and to allow movement.
AJ, it's a low-cost intervention. That's the reality, is that this is not a pharmaceutical, and it's an extremely low-cost educational intervention in the real world, in real-world terms. And
with huge impact.
I was going to say, and I think that the results and the impacts already, the bits that we've studied it through Johns Hopkins University and another colleague from New York University, a sociology professor, those preliminary results showing statistically significant increases in students' state reading scores in grade 4, that would be revolutionary if we could really show a causal connection, which of course is probably very, it is almost impossible, colleagues say, to do, but we were for many years really hoping to do more research around the work, or bringing in consultants, clearly not, necessarily doing it ourselves, but having external evaluators. We have to take it to a certain scale to do that, probably like 50 schools in a control where mm-hmm. 25 get the intervention, 25 are the controls, so you compensate them in a different way. Yeah. But it's very expensive. And unfortunately, there's a transience in New York City and a transience sometimes in our public education system, not only of children who get pulled out to go back home somewhere to another country in the middle of the school year for months or whatever it might be, or even the staffs. The principals shift up pretty regularly across the system. So the idea of institutional knowledge sometimes is a bit of a challenge. So I do hope that I can attract support and other colleagues to join forces with me who have those expertises, both in the organization of the study, but, organizing and recruiting the schools to make a commitment to it. If we get that in place, then I think that would be very exciting to keep these studies going that we've been doing. They're very promising. They've shown promising results.
Early May, Cinco de Mayo celebrations for the 35th anniversary of Marc de Garmo dance. What should we wish you?
Well, it's a coral color, apparently, which is the theme color for the 35th anniversary. So I don't know. I think of that. If that's coral, then good health and prosperity and success. And,
absolutely.
And onward, most of all.
Yes. What I wish is that Marc de Garmo dance will be able to keep doing this amazing work, and for a bunch of kids to more and more benefit from this program, because it is innovation at its best for social change using dance that way. Happy 35th!
Oh, thank you, Anjali. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for being with us today. You can refer to the show notes for more information and links about the subjects we've discussed in this episode. I hope you've been able to identify how you can integrate innovation and creativity in your daily life. If you would like to dive in or know more, you can contact me on my website, enoughcrea.com. Special thanks to Millimétrique, who composed my music themes. I encourage you to discover his music on Bandcamp. Thank you for listening, and bye for now.